meeting of the Civil Justice Committee will come to order. Representative Jackson moves the minutes of March 17th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no, carries. Who wants to? Representative Hillstrom moves House File 3106, and then...
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A20 amendment as well.
Okay, and then Representative Hillstrom moves the A20 amendment, and my understanding, Representative Bigum, is that, that's okay with you to get it in the shape?
Yep.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no, carries. And Representative Gruskowski, I think you wanted to move the A21 amendment? Oh, I'm sorry.
You know, we just passed this amendment, can you tell me what it did?
Sure. Mr. Chair?
Someone tell me what it did.
Okay, I thought that was going to be explained as part of the presentation.
You asked me to vote on it before I even knew what the hell it...
Representative, well, what we asked to vote on was to get it in the shape the author wanted, which we...
I understand, but I'd like to know what it does, because I'm not sure, I'm not happy with what's going on here today.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, in the Public Safety Policy Committee, the committee voted to take out first-time offenders that had a blood concentration of less than 2.0 out of this program, and to, when we did it, the language of the amendment was not accurate, and we ended up affecting second-time offenders as well, which we had no intention of doing. And so this amendment was to clean up and actually make the language reflect what the committee thought they were doing in my committee. It just was a cleanup amendment.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Mr. Chair, what did it originally do to the first-time offenders?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's current law, or what is the current practice, is that if you're a first-time offender, you can qualify for a limited license, and the bill actually did a longer period of hard revocation, and it also lowered the limit at which time you would be required to do ignition interlock. It doesn't say you can't, it just says that you don't have to. And so it put back what was current law for first-time offenders.
So, Mr. Chair.
To current law.
Representative Mahoney.
So are the first-time offenders going to be on an alcohol interlock?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They are not required to be under ignition interlock for first-time offenders. It goes back to current law, which is what my committee chose to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bigum.
Representative Mahoney, there is no reason they couldn't be on it if they so chose.
Representative Mahoney.
I think it passed almost unanimously, but I'd like to recommend that my voice vote was a no.
Okay, thank you. We'll record that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert, sorry.
Just for clarification purposes, if they, now that this is set so that on the first time they're not required to do this, if they choose to do interlock, what's the benefit or trade-off?
Representative Bigum.
Mr. Chair, this is what I'm gonna just recommend for clarity so we save some time here. I think what we should do before we move Representative Gruskowski's amendment, because Representative Hillstrom's amendment was a technical clarification change from her committee. What I would ask the chair, if you would indulge, is to allow the department and Secretary of State Ritchie to make comments, explain the bill, then we do Representative Gruskowski's amendment so that members can see what is changing in it. But to answer your question, Representative Holbert, it would be what the governor's plan is here, which would be a longer revocation. If they're not on it, it's current law, I'm sorry.
Which is 6 months.
Correct.
And so if they choose to do interlock...
Then it goes into the governor's plan.
Okay, then they're on interlock for 6 months?
Yes.
With interlock, and then at 6 months, they're done with interlock on a first time?
Yes, yeah, and during that 6 months' time, they'll have full driving privileges. So at this moment, I think we should have the bill explained and have Commissioner Campion, Secretary of State Ritchie, and the bill explained, and then go into the amendment, if that is all right with the chair.
Can I ask one really quick question?
Representative Holbert.
If they choose, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Bigum, if they choose on a first time to 6 months of interlock, do they avoid the $700 approximate reinstatement fee?
No.
No.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Driscoll.
If I could recommend following what Representative Bigum suggested, members, in your packet, the department has prepared a chart that's got yellow and green and red on it, and if you would take a, maybe reference that and the other handouts in your packet, and maybe the department, as Representative Bigum had suggested, can go ahead and explain it. These visuals I find to be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, members.
Commissioner Campion.
It is my name. I'm Commissioner of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to come here today. We're here in support of this bill. It has the support of the criminal justice system, the traffic safety community here throughout Minnesota. This is a smart bill. It makes the best use of advanced technology, yet in keeping our roads safer with the passages than our roads are now. It's also a compassionate bill in the sense that it allows for people to legally drive, or an avenue to legally drive after a DWI arrest. And so it would be, I think, have a major impact in cutting down on the number of people who drive after revocation. With that, Madam, Mr. Chair, members, I certainly would request that it has the full support of the Department of Public Safety, and the governor would ask for your support on it. Thank you.
And Mr. Secretary of State, you were going to speak on this also. Mr. Ritchie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I really appreciate this privilege and opportunity to testify briefly today. It's about something that I feel very strongly about, and I've been very appreciative of Chairman Mullery's leadership on this technology and getting us to think about this over the past 10 years. 10 years ago, just about, my wife and I lost our daughter to a drunk driver who had a history of alcoholism and run-ins with the law related to alcohol. And her airbag and her seatbelt could not save her life, but could this technology have saved her life? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I would have grandkids now. I don't know. But what I do know is that the pilot projects that we've done in Minnesota and in other states will save lives. I do know that some people will be spared the grief and the sorrow that my wife and I have experienced and experience every day. I know it will save taxpayers and people who buy medical insurance a tremendous amount of money. If you want to be sobered sometime, you can read through the itemized bill from HCMC for the accident and all the repercussions of an accident in just one instance, my daughter. But I also want to say that this bill and taking this bill forward, because this certainly isn't enough, it's just a good next step. This bill can help perhaps another young person not have to live their life knowing they killed somebody, not have to live their life with the grief, the sorrow, the guilt, and also the stigma of a felony, a prison time, of knowing somewhere that you had robbed a family, you had robbed someone of one of their loved ones in some way and fashion. If you can use this bill and keep moving the process forward to help save a life, to help save a family from grief and sorrow, to save taxpayers' money, to save the criminal justice system from incredible cost, that would be important. But if you could help somebody to not have to live a life of guilt and shame because they didn't kill somebody or maim someone, this bill would have done a tremendous amount of good. Thank you so much for this opportunity, and thank you for your leadership in moving this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie.
Thank you.
Ms. Marty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First off, I just want to say that, for the record, my name is Cherie Marty. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And we are very pleased to have this hearing, and we know that the department, among our stakeholders, we've talked to many of you one-on-one about our bill, and we are grateful for those one-on-one conversations. As you know, the department started off with proposing the governor's bill, and that's really been based on a comprehensive group of stakeholders that care a lot about impaired driving in Minnesota, and as well as data. And those stakeholders helped to shape that governor's proposal. But as you know, as the bill has worked through committees on the House side, there's been a number of permutations of that bill. And so I just want to say that what I'd like to do now is just go through very briefly what the highlights of that bill is, the current second engrossment of House File 3106. And before I begin, Mr. Chair, if I could just acknowledge your role in helping to shape Ignition Interlock in Minnesota. We are very grateful that you did, in fact, was the lead chair and the lead author of the first two bills that established our two-county pilot, as well as broadening that pilot to the statewide Ignition Interlock program. So I just want to thank you very much for helping to shape where we are today. All right, so if you turn in your packet, there is a blue chart, and I'm going to just turn to that blue chart. The first page are a number of benefits that Commissioner Campion did cover. Your cover page looks like this. So this is the handout that you want to turn to. Okay. And then it's not in there?
Yes, it's in most of them.
Blue folder.
Oh, it's in there.
There we go. Blue folder. All right.
Oh, okay.
I can breathe. All right. The first page are benefits, and I believe that Commissioner Campion did touch on a number of these benefits. I think the only additional one that I really would like to comment on is that our proposal does promote successful rehabilitation for chronic DWI offenders, repeat offenders, those high risks, through the monitoring done by the Ignition Interlock device. And that monitoring, coupled with treatment, is very effective in changing that underlying chemical dependency problem, which contributes to drinking and driving. So that's just the additional benefit I wanted to highlight. So now we're going to turn to the blue matrix. And the first page, this page deals with first and second time offenders. You'll notice that we have three columns. The first column under current is current law. The second column, proposal, is the governor's proposal. The third column is House File 3106, the second engrossment. So, just generally speaking, you'll notice that for this first page, you've got first-time offenders at 0.20 and above, second-time offenders, and then second-time offenders at 0.20 and above for current law. If you move over to the right column on the right side, you'll notice that for each offense, first and second time, as well as the enhancements, that there is a short period of no driving, often referred to as hard revocation. So that would be a 15-day period of no driving privileges. That is then followed by a revocation period. And for first and second times, as the bill currently stands, they can choose to go on limited license to drive to on Ignition Interlock to drive to work, school, treatment, the things that they need to do. They can choose to have that limited license on Ignition Interlock. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. They can choose to have the limited license, or they can choose to go on Ignition Interlock and have full driving privileges. I apologize for misspeaking initially. Is that clear? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoover.
So are you saying the last column does not reflect this, the amendment that's being proposed? Can you, as you go through this, or at some point summarize what this does to the final column?
And Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I came in late. I'm sorry. Whose amendment is this?
You're looking at the wrong amendment, I believe.
No, the one that she's referring to.
A21 is what I was talking about.
Right.
Oh, you're referring
I'm just wondering where this came.
Oh, you're referring to A21?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's Representative Drazkowski's amendment.
And hasn't been offered yet.
It has not been offered yet.
Can we go ahead, Representative Amar? Thank you. Ms. Marty.
All right, so you can see that I think I've covered sufficiently generally what you're looking at for the first and second time offenders. If you turn to the second page, this is the page for third time offenders and more. These are chronic high risk offenders. They have a canceled license. These are canceled as inimical to public safety. Again, you have a period of no driving privileges, and this is now at 30 days. Again, third time offender in 10 years or fourth or more on record. What you have here then is they will go on ignition interlock. For the first year, they will have a limited license on ignition interlock. Again, driving to work, school, doctor, doing the necessity and treatment. Then they will have full driving privileges on ignition interlock for the remaining portion of their revocation period. So that essentially is the bill. Are there any questions?
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, the reinstatement of driving privileges, how do you determine the verification of abstinence for 3 years in order to get your privileges back?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the abstinence is verified by the ignition interlock device. Also, under the current amendment.
So you don't mean abstinence in terms of, Mr. Chair, pure abstinence. You just mean drive. No one has
Ms.
attempted
Marty.
To drive while under the influence.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jean Ryan from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The way the bill stands today is it is abstinence in and out of the vehicle until further amendments are proposed. It would require abstinence by no alcohol detection by the ignition interlock device. But if there was any other kind of report, verified chemical test report, so if a person was arrested for some reason and somebody detected alcohol, they did a chemical test, like a preliminary breath test, and it detected alcohol, it would be a detection of alcohol.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. Representative Mahoney.
So, Ms. Ryan, Ryan, correct?
Correct.
There'd be no having to go in for a UI of any sorts or the proverbial cup in the bathroom?
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there would be no requirement of random urinalysis test.
Thank you. Just one second. I see some people that are interested in House File, I believe it's 1157. We're not going to do that this morning. We're taking that off the calendar. It was only if there was no question or contest. So we're not going to do that if that's what you're waiting for. I'm sorry, Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick clarification, and now you got me thinking the other bill. But just for verification, under the presently existing rules, just to set the record straight, there isn't any cup test or anything either, right? So this doesn't really change anything about that.
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, you're correct. We do not require that, and it does not change anything.
Thank you. Representative Hobart.
But Mr. Chair,
just 1 second. Was there more on that, or I saw you two talking. Was there more to say on that, or no? Okay, Representative Hobart. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, frequently in these situations, people are put under probation and may have to check in once a month and do a test or whatever, and so you would have testing being done within the system. So if there was a positive UA for other drugs and or alcohol not related to driving while they were under court supervision, how would that affect this interlock program?
Ms. Ryan or Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes. Actually, if the probation department would like to share that information with the Department of Public Safety, they don't all the time share that information, but if they wanted to share that information with the Department of Public Safety saying that there was alcohol detection during a certain time period, it would be an extension of the time period required to use ignition interlock device.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
just to add on to that, this is a civil process, where the process you're talking about is criminal, and in no way, shape, or form would this null and void anything that a probation officer would require as a terms of condition for a criminal proceeding.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that, but if you're dealing with an individual that's been identified as having a problem and they're continuing to use drugs, and they're maybe not drinking or using alcohol under the Interlock system, they, you know, quite obviously are breaking some terms of their rehabilitation or whatever. And I mean, my experience with the system is that chronic offenders are getting away with things they shouldn't be getting away with, and the lack of consequences is really detrimental to the public safety. And so when I hear you say, well, if probation shares it with public safety, why isn't probation sharing it with public safety, would be my question.
Yeah. Representative Bigham?
Well, I don't have an exact answer to that. Well, just out of maybe reversing the question, and maybe I'm just going to ask the testifiers, just out of curiosity, would you be sharing, if you had some positive results on the breathalyzer or the ignition lock, I mean, would you be sharing that with probation? I mean, maybe that's kind of a different way to ask the question, too, because that's where the criminal proceeding would happen. Do you guys share that information if there's a violation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what could be done is if the court said, the court side, so probation, could have access to this data from the service provider. So if the court chose to make a condition of their probation that they are using ignition or lock on the car and they do want to have that information from the service provider, they can have access to this information from the provider of any alcohol use and any kind of downloads from the ignition or lock device.
Okay, I guess we can go ahead then. Were you done? Oh, Representative Payman?
I'll wait until they're done with their presentation. I have some more questions.
Okay. I guess they're done. Representative Payman.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Bigham, and to the testifiers, I think the bill has improved a lot, and I appreciate the work you've done on it. I had a couple of questions on the actual technology, and I know that this should have probably been asked in an earlier committee, but the interlock devices, how many manufacturers actually produce this interlock device in Minnesota or anywhere for that matter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, we have certified 4 ignition interlock service providers in Minnesota at this time. There are additional service providers that would be willing to provide service, I'm sure, if they expand. We recently have expanded the use of ignition interlocks, so it has become more of a desired state to do business in than previously.
And Mr. Chair, and how do we know that these are reliable, given that all of the controversy over some of the breathalyzers with threatened to throw a lot of cases out of the system? Are we fairly certain they're reliable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, each service provider has to go through, or device that's used in Minnesota has to go through a certification process. Part of that certification process is going through a chemical lab testing that verifies that it is being calibrated accurately. Every 30 days, then in Minnesota, we're requiring them to go into a service provider to be calibrated and verified that it is accurate.
And the service provider, Mr. Chair, is whom?
The service providers are companies that are locations where the vendor is contracted with to do business in Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Campion, or Mr. Jordahl, I assume that since some of the earlier questions about the cost to the Department of Public Safety, that you are going to absorb these costs of certification, or I guess I should have asked.
Ms. Ryan.
I can't remember. Ms. Ryan.
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, we have already certified those 4 companies through the pilot program. What we will require them to do is yearly file an application to reapply for doing business in Minnesota, because we would want to verify the information is continued to be accurate.
And, Mr. Chair, are these costs then coming out of the transportation side of the Department of Public Safety, or the side that public safety part that we would be more concerned about? Or I might be more concerned about. Just trying to get where there are some costs here to the department. I'm just trying to figure out where they're coming from, because if it doesn't come out of the division, public safety finance division, then I suppose we don't need to hear the bill. But if it does, then we should.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and to respond to Representative Paymar's question, the Driver and Vehicle Services Division's revenue and appropriations are in the transportation budget, as well as is the Office of Traffic Safety, but we would, our staff would be the ones that would be monitoring the ignition interlock and working with the participants, and so all the costs associated with this program would be in our Driver and Vehicle Services budget.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I got two quick questions here. I don't know where it is, but after the last hearing, I talked to Mr. Simon from the university, who I would hope that this would happen. So it answers one of my questions, but he says the technology is very close to where you wouldn't have to have everybody blow into the interlock device in order to trigger it, and that you'd be able to have almost a fingerprint that would establish that you are indeed the drunk driver who is going. I don't know where that is, but I hope that that comes to fruition rather quickly. But there's this one provision on page 11 that the participant shall pay costs with the associated with the ignition interlock device on every motor vehicle. If you have more than one motor vehicle in your family, which many families do, would all motor vehicle, would all of the cars then come under this umbrella here, or could you specify that this is the car that I typically drive to work and whatever, and the rest of the cars don't have to have the interlocks, or do all of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, you would designate what car you plan on driving. Any car you plan on driving, you will be required to have ignition interlock installed on it. So it's a restriction on the driver's license that only allows you to drive a vehicle with ignition interlock on it. You could drive a vehicle that you don't even own if it has an ignition interlock installed on it.
So, Mr. Chair, so sort of on your honor, then, you wouldn't drive another vehicle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, it would be a crime if you drove another vehicle without ignition interlock on it.
Okay, that's all for now. Thank you.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions that came up in my committee that we were going to continue to talk about is, in the event someone else drives the vehicle and they happen to, because toothpaste and some mouthwashes can set off the ignition interlock at a very low level. And we asked some questions about how would you verify that the person that violated in the car or set it off was actually the person who has the problem. Because, for example, if your child or your wife used mouthwash, drove the car, set off the ignition interlock, then that would be extending the time that you have to be on ignition interlock, because that would be a violation. So, one, how do you verify that it was the person, and two, is there an appeals process if you extend the time that they have to be on it if they can prove that it wasn't them?
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, first, what we would want to do is, for instance, if the device detects alcohol based on scope or some other kind of outside other than alcohol, what it does is it requires you then to breathe into it soon after, like within 5 minutes. That detection of alcohol is eliminated at that point in time. that would be not counted as a detection of alcohol, because you can tell by the reports, and we've been looking at a lot of these reports, you can immediately tell that it was something else that triggered it. It was not alcohol. If it's alcohol, it will remain high. And if somebody else blew into it, there would be an appeal process through the Driver and Vehicle Services Office that they could administratively appeal.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Felsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does that appeals process currently exist, or is that something that you're creating?
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, there is an appeal process in any action that the Department of Public Safety does that's already in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kelly. She has you on the list for a question. No? Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the penalty if they are driving a non-interlocked car and they're required to be driving only interlocked cars?
Ms. Representative Bigel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, it's a misdemeanor.
Pardon?
Misdemeanor.
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, it also, besides being a misdemeanor, we would extend that person's time on using ignition interlock as well.
Okay, I think we're ready for Representative Drazkowski's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the
A21
amendment.
Okay. And my understanding, the author is okay with this amendment to get it in the shape.
Well, I'm neutral on amendments, okay. But I think I heard my good friend Representative Mahoney wants to have it explained.
Okay.
So if we could do that before we vote on it, but okay. I'm neutral on all amendments.
Okay.
Representative, this is a department and the governor's bill.
Representative Drazkowski, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A21 amendment. Let me make sure we got the right section here. Lines 1.2 through 1.5 takes the second time offense and makes it a one-year revocation if they're under 0.20 and two-year revocation if they're above 0.20. Lines 1.6 through 1.16 this is the removal of the B card language, and what that would do is instead of looking at or having the current language talks about abstinence from alcohol in any place, whether you're in your car or in the backyard barbecue wherever you might be. Currently, with the B card, the way it works is that any violation or detected violation of the abstinence from alcohol is a violation, and they would lose their license. So what this does is says not a drop while you're behind the wheel of a car, and that's where it ends it. This provision, the discussion earlier about costs will, at least in my estimation, will save the department some money and maybe allow them to allocate some of those resources towards the ignition interlock program. Lines 1.7 through 1.20, those lines take out an amendment that I put on the bill in Representative Hillstrom's committee that was Representative Paymar's left, that basically told the department that they couldn't exercise the B card. So it's redundant language, and that intent is taken care of, as I mentioned, in 1.6 through 1.16. 1.21 through 1.23 puts a provision in there that says that the default of 0.02 on the equipment in the car will go from, or the calibration, I should say, on the equipment in the car will go from 0.02 to 0.05 on the 1st of January of 2013. And this is a deliberate attempt to bring the legislature back to revisit that provision, because I know that there's some members that would like to, look at that. The last couple of lines of the amendment are technical changes that are required to make everything fit.
Representative Bigum.
First, I would just like to say I want to thank Representative Drazkowski for his work on this, and for you, Mr. Chair. I know that, and I appreciate the time that all us in the department and partisan staff, all and nonpartisan staff, put in on this to get this amendment in the shape that we need to keep the bill moving. I think that the amendment is a reasonable middle ground for us to proceed with the bill. I will let the department now put their take on it.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, again, we have appreciated the conversations and the discussions, and we have, over the last 2 years, we've been working with a number of stakeholders, 63 specifically, representing all aspects of DWI, chemical dependency, probation, law enforcement, and so forth. And we have crafted our recommendations, but as you know, there has been some changes to our initial proposal. And so we do have some reservations about the amendment. However, we do leave this up to the will of the committee. And I...
Representative Hoover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can somebody tell me, if this amendment goes on, what happens to people that have been carrying a B card for 15 or 20 years, have had no violations? What happens to them?
Ms. Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, if the person has been carrying a notation on their driver's license saying canceled as inimical to public safety for the last over 10-year time period, beyond 10 years, and has had absolutely no alcohol restriction or violations of some sort, right, the department would review that. And if that's true, they would remove the restriction from the license.
And, Mr. Chair, how does that process occur? Do they have to, like, write a letter and say, no, I've been good for 20 years, can I be free now, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I misspoke. The way the bill is written now, what we were planning on doing is actually removing it for all violations. For all people that are canceled and inimical to public safety, they would be able to have that restriction removed from their card. They could remove it from the driving record as well if it's been beyond 10 years.
And Mr. Chair, how, and Ms. Ryan or Representative Drazkowski, how does your amendment affect that or change that, if any?
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Holberg and members, if we look at the chart the department put together that's got the bright yellow and the different shades of green on it, start with page 2 of that. In my discussions with the department, I asked them many of those same questions, Representative Holberg, and wanted to get an idea from the department on what some of the rules that they would be writing around the details of this would look like, so we could have an idea as a legislature to know what, how they would intend to do the rule writing to follow through with the intent of the statute should the bill be adopted by the legislature and signed into law. So those elements are included in this sheet here, and I guess if members have any specific questions for the department, they can ask. I'd also flip back
so
to
just
Representative Holbrook.
Real quickly to this point then, so they would have to pay, is it the $20 fee for a duplicate license to get a clear license?
Ms. McCormick.
Or whatever it is.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I think the fee is $12.50, and that would be what they would have to pay. And basically that just covers the cost of the manufacturing of the card.
And, Mr. Chair, if they chose to do this at their time of their driver's license renewal, there wouldn't be any additional charge, and how would they go about doing that?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I'm sure if they came in to do that, we'd refer them to a driver evaluator who would take care of reviewing the record, making sure that everything was okay for us to move forward, and then that would be removed.
So, Mr. Chair, that would involve an appointment down with somebody in St. Paul to reveal your lifestyle, et cetera, or what?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, we have evaluators here in St. Paul and at all of our metro exam stations, and an evaluator gets to every part of the state within 3 weeks. Most, the only ones you'd have to get an appointment ahead of time with would be the ones out in greater Minnesota. But it wouldn't be a formal interview. It would just be a matter of working through that to facilitate that quick review of the record so that then they could apply. And if it was part of a renewal, it would be done as the renewal, so they would pay the renewal fee.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask members to look at the colored diagram on the front page. The very dark line there would indicate the point at which the ignition interlock license wording would come off of the driver's license. The line between the light green and the dark green would be the time at which it came off of the record. And as I talked to the department, and maybe they want to talk more about it, they're, you know, looking at a total of 10 years there. If you add up, you know, the third through the fifth violations and beyond, if you add up the time on ignition interlock and the not a drop behind the wheel section under the green area there, it's consistently 10 years for each of those, but allocated differently. The greater the number of violations you get, the longer you're on ignition interlock during that 10-year period.
Okay, then all in favor of the 820 amendment, say aye.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, aye. Sorry, Representative Mahoney.
You know, I was waiting till this was done because, till the vote, because this is an incident where we have the choice of two bad choices, literally. I just don't understand, Representative Drazkowski. Someone's had 2, 3, 4, 5 DWIs. They've gotten into a car. They've gotten into a 10,000-pound weapon and driven it down the road. And you're saying, oh, well, you should be able to drink anytime you want so long as you don't get behind the wheel of a car. When they're drunk, when they're stupid, they're going to get behind the wheel of a car. In order to move DWI laws forward with this amendment, I just don't understand how we as a society allow felons to get in a vehicle that is the other side, just the same thing as walking down the street with a gun, loaded, in their hand. I can't understand it. And I'm going to vote no on this amendment. I'm going to vote yes on the bill. But to say we put a person in prison for trying to shoot somebody 4 or 5 times, we put them in prison for life. But now they can go to the backyard barbecue and pretend nothing happened. It dismays me.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just respond briefly. Well, Representative Mahoney, this would remove the B-card violations or the B-card provisions that have evolved administratively in this state over many, many years. None of the surrounding states, at least I've been told, have this provision. And we've got about 46 states now, 44 or 46 states, something like that, that have ignition interlock. And what the entire bill does, and with the removal of the B-card violation, does focus the policy of the state on focusing on people's behavior when they're in the car instead of trying to engineer their lifestyle. And so that's what the intent of the amendment is. And I understand your objections to it and your passion about your experiences, but that's what it does.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
you know, we engineer the lifestyle of someone who's attempted to murder someone for a very, very long time. But I guess we don't have to do that any longer.
Okay. All in favor of the A21 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the bill? If not, Representative Hillstrom. Okay. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass the bill as amendment, pass House File 3106 as amended, and send it to Finance with a re-referral to Transportation Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Loeffler.
No, I get it.
I feel sort of convinced that, but I do think there are.
Representative Loeffler, I will move here. The chair will move Representative Loeffler's House File 1531.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler, where does this go?
To the General Register.
To the General Register. Mm-hmm. And there's no amendments, is my understanding.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Loeffler, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1531 is a bill that clarifies the role and responsibilities of classified state employees, the civil servants that we hire based on their education and experience, and says that during their work hours, they're to serve as nonpartisan resources to all state decision makers in both the executive and legislative branches, and that any issues in terms of workload and things like that would be worked out with their supervisors. Obviously, their number one job is to do the job they've been hired to do. But I think all of us have run into situations in which we have asked even basic information questions and been told by state agency employees that they've been told they can't talk to legislators, they have to go through a process, and you get the information about a week after, significantly after the hearing for which you needed the information to make good policy choices. And so this, and I think this has just been evolving over time. I think all of our state employees see themselves as professional resources to all of us in doing our work. But there's been kind of a growing sense that that they're a part of the executive's team, and therefore being disloyal or not allowed to assist legislators in the same way to understand state services and the impact of the choices before us. So that's Section 1 just clarifies that. It does provide that this does not authorize an employee to disclose data that's not public under Chapter 13, which protects the right of our executive branch and our governor to make budget proposals, to analyze policies, and not have that disclosed to legislators before the governor decides to release them or decides that that's not a policy choice he or she wants to pursue. Section 2 provides whistleblower protection such that an employee in the classified service cannot be discharged or disciplined if they communicate in good faith information they believe to be truthful and accurate to a legislator, the legislative auditor, or a constitutional officer. And with that, I'd be glad to respond to questions.
Ms. Loeffler, I believe there's Assistant Commissioner Holmes wanted to testify in this, I believe. Could you state what department?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Holmes. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget. Have just a few comments about this bill. I guess one of the first things I want to say is sometimes there's a good reason that some employees might not want to talk directly to a legislator, or an agency might not want just anybody talking to a legislator. Oftentimes individual employees might not be aware of the full of all the technical aspects or policy aspects of a subject, so it's not uncommon for someone to say, if you get questions from the legislature, refer it to the assistant director or whatever just to make sure that you get the full information. Another reason that sometimes communication is directed through a particular person in the agency is because of data practices concerns. I know that this legislation doesn't excuse violations or allow for violations of data practices, but at the same time, a lot of employees can't make some of those distinctions. You and I know how complicated that law is in terms of what's public and what's private data. Since the agency is ultimately liable for anything that's any information that's communicated, sometimes we like to get it, have it go out through a certain person who's aware of data practices concerns. The other reason you might sometimes not have employees be real forthcoming is sometimes I know that they're afraid to talk to a legislator. They're afraid of what's going to happen with that, and it's not uncommon that they like the fact that they can pass on an inquiry to a directed person in the agency. The other comments I want to make is there are two parts to this bill, the whistleblower part and then the other part that is, has it been incorporated, the amendment? Yeah, an addition to 43A. The whistleblower law has very specific sorts of acts that employees do that are protected, as in if an employer is violating a law and an employee brings that forward, yes, they're protected by the Whistleblower Act. This addition to the Whistleblower Act is very sort of a little on the vague side and general. All it talks about is if an employee communicates information that relates to state services. That's pretty broad as opposed to reporting a violation of the law by an employer. Keep in mind the Whistleblower Act creates a civil cause of action. You can go to district court. We're talking attorneys, AGs, we're talking penalties. Whether or not that's the appropriate sort of solution to the problem that you see, I think with the amendment to 43A that's in the bill, I think that's a better approach, because if an employee has some sort of negative action from the employer, gets discharged, gets suspended, gets disciplined in any way, they have a grievance procedure, they can challenge it, they can point to this change in 43A that's being proposed, and that should protect them.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler, did you want to make any more comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, in terms of the first points about state employees feeling uncomfortable talking to legislators or not knowing what they can or can't disclose under data privacy laws, nothing in this says that the absolute first person that you call has to give you every piece of information they know, but it does say that they're to be to provide timely professional assistance and to be resources to us. And I think that's been part of the problem, is that there has not been timeliness. There has not necessarily been, it's gotten to the point, and it's varied by agency, but that I had a constituent who was hired by a state agency, and I knew this, and I saw him a couple months later, and I said, "Hi, how's it going? How's on the new job?" And he said, "Well, just fine, but I've been told I can't talk to legislators anything about my work." It's gotten to that point that they can't even say, have a normal conversation with people. I've had people who I have called in state agencies are program directors. They are not people who are low-level, uncomfortable, being asked questions, and who have said to me, "I'm sorry, I've just been told I cannot talk to legislators at all, but if you have a specific question, I'll write it up." And so you can't have the kind of give and take as you're trying to understand what does a program do. You have to have a very detailed set of questions that you submit, and then they submit it to someone else, and then you get the response back. It's not a professional opportunity to learn how a program is really working and not working. And I think that's not the intent, but I think the way it has been translated through various state agencies has been to a point where even our staff hasn't. It's interesting because a member of the public can call and ask the exact same question, and they can spend a half hour with that same person and get all the information they need and want about how it works and how it doesn't work. And I don't think the intent was for us to have to ask constituents to get information for us if we need it in a quick and timely way. I don't think that's the purpose. In terms of the second concern, about putting this within the whistleblower statute, I would say that, you know, this would never be invoked unless there was a very, very serious situation in which someone felt that, I mean, I don't think state agencies are in the habit of disciplining or discharging people or providing information to us. But I have been contacted by state employees who feel like they would need this level of protection to be able to share concerns that they might have about serious transgressions within their agencies or information that they have, and that this gives them the confidence that they would have to explain things. And this is hearsay information, but after the 35W bridge went down, I have to say there were people who told me that they went to union conventions and were shown pictures, and people shared their fears about particular how we weren't paying attention to our infrastructure, but they felt like they couldn't communicate that to anyone. That would not have changed, I don't think, 35W. I think that was related to the construction that was done on it. But it does point to me that I think that there are people who feel like they aren't able to communicate real needs to us in a way that they feel comfortable, and that this would provide that sort of protection. But I do think my goal in this is, quite honestly, is to evolve us back to a situation that I think and believe existed when I was first a state employee early in my career, in which really, if you served in the state, you felt like you were hired for your professional skills and your expertise and your experience, and that you were to help the state, not just the executive, but the state, the legislature, everybody be well-informed and making good decisions, and that you weren't on one team or another, that you were like our House Research Department, that you didn't take a side, you just used your professional information and you conveyed that. And I think that we've drifted from that, and I'm hoping that this will help bring us back to that.
Representative Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, two things. I think your language on line 16 and 17 of page 1 should actually be amended to be closer to what's on lines 22 and 23. You just identified chapter 13, but there's classifications of data throughout the statute. So I wouldn't just say chapter 13. I'd say otherwise protected by law or something. So that, you know, it's a better way to do it, I think, than calling out just one chapter. And then my second question is, why under your new, on page 2, your new language on starting on line 17, why do you call out the legislators, the legislative auditor, or constitutional officer when, from your testimony, it appears you want this protection for discussions with everybody, the state? It's like you exclude the public, or you exclude lobbyists, or I don't understand why you made that delineation.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Loeffler.
And Representative Holberg, well, you have far more experience than I do about data privacy and disclosures. I just really this was narrowed to really apply to them serving state decision makers. And while there may be other issues in terms of information being disclosed to other legitimate parties, I wasn't prepared to take that on because I'm not an expert on data privacy and data issues. And it's really just saying that they are to be a resource to all state decision makers. And so I see this as the list of those. And the legislative auditor is listed because of the unique role that that plays in terms of being an investigatory arm of us when there is an issue that's been identified. Mr. Chairman, on the first comment that Representative Holberg had about not narrowing it to Chapter 13, I respect her judgment and the judgment of the committee on data privacy things. I'm not an expert on that, as I said, and if that's a more typical language, I would be open to an amendment on that. But it was to particularly make sure that our current provisions are honored.
Representative Holberg,
well, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Gehring's probably at the ready here of how we could amend the Section 1 of the bill to be more broad in its reference.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think to do this amendment, as you suggested, on page 1, line 17, you could delete "that is not public data" under Chapter 13 and insert otherwise protected by law, so that that whole sentence would read, "This section does not authorize or require an employee to disclose data otherwise protected by law."
Works for me.
Is that okay, Representative Loeffler?
That is, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move amendment on line 117, delete "that is not public data" under chapter 13 and insert "otherwise protected by law." All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Chair.
With that, Representative Paymer.
I just wanted to explore that that Representative Holbrook was talking about just a bit further. And I mean, I'm okay with the language. It's too complicated to change on page 2, but I mean, the legislative auditor clearly has subpoena power and great authority over investigations that it's using. So I'm just wondering. I would ask that question also of why you're just excluding the good faith aspect to a legislator, to just the legislator, legislative auditor, and a constitutional officer.
Mr. Chair, and
if there's a way to broaden this, because
Representative Paymar, originally the bill as introduced actually had a little bit more broader language, and the Senate narrowed it, and their council felt strongly that that narrowing was appropriate. So I have to say I wasn't part of that discussion. But we had it to the original wording that we had as the bill was introduced was a legislator or an employee in the legislative branch or an elected official in the executive branch. So it included our staff as well, but it still kept it to that leadership function within state government. And I think, you know, whistleblower statutes are fairly significant pieces of policy and protection and law, and they should be. I really, truly was just focusing on making sure that these staff were serving all branches of the government. And I'm not a lawyer, and I wasn't willing to take on the judicial branch and how that works. I figured they have enough authority as it is.
Representative Mahoney, did you have a...
No, I like the original language better, but this is what...
Mr. Chair, and actually I'm going to disagree, and Representative Loeffler and Representative Paymar, in the area where I work more in the legislature, I run up against unintended consequences so often that it is sometimes a pretty decent idea to make some limitations on, because my concern with this kind of language, if we start adding to it, is that a smart lawyer comes along and all of a sudden a public employee is required at a public meeting to have that same kind of openness that is probably best used in these buildings versus elsewhere. And I'm only taking the worst case scenario. So the unintended consequences of some of the things that we do, I do kind of like this. Although I have to admit, I don't know why you'd have the legislative auditor in there, because they do have an awful broad authority.
Representative Christoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I appreciate the idea, but the language on page 2 just seems to be very, very broad. Not the applicability of the language, but the language in 2.18, "in good faith beliefs to be truthful and accurate." Is there any way to refine that and focus it more? It just seems open to exploitation.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Juskowski, I think if you look at the other sections that this is being added to in that same section of law, it's similar. And I think that, you know, you can't identify every single potential system. If you just look on line 2.10, the quality of healthcare services, my God, there's been, you know, you could put 100 pages of statutes trying to define what do you mean by quality of health services. I think the intent is to give some broad framework to the interpretation of this if it is to be applied and challenged. But I don't think I would find it difficult to kind of define all the different potential questions in which the legislative branch might seek information from the classified employee of the state It could be about the number of people served. It could be about decisions made about federal grant applications. I mean, there's so many different potential things that all the different varied state agencies do. I think it would be hard to delineate them further. It's my hope that this never has to be actually invoked, and that we do have a situation in which people can give us good, accurate information without feeling like there's any threat, and that the processes that the administrative and executive branch establishes makes them feel comfortable that employees do know what they can and can't convey, and when they should be checking with others to make sure they understand it. I have no problem with an employee who says, I met with Representative Loeffler and we had a half hour discussion on X, Y, and Z, and this is the kind of, and it, you know, a check-in, that's, I don't have any problem with that. What I have a problem with is when people are told they're not to work with this, they're not to convey information, that there's a very stilted relationship that has to be through, you know, almost written questions. And that, you know, that isn't useful. And so I'm hoping that this is starts to create a standard. And I think that passing it right now, when we're going to be going into a new leader, because our current governor is not running for re-election, this just kind of sets the rules as the new administration, whoever that is, puts together their policies and directions and leadership teams.
Representative Elster.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, help me understand when you narrow it to those three categories. So I'm going to give you a situation. A classified state employee is participating in conversation with a legislator and a citizen. The employee has protections for that same conversation with the legislator, but does not have the whistleblower protection with the citizen. So the citizen can file, because you've only narrowed this protection to those three categories: legislative, auditor, legislature, and constitutional officers. So help me understand the rationale for that.
Representative Boston.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, quite honestly, I think public information should be freely available to anyone, whether they're a citizen or a legislator or anyone else. I was addressing it, as I said, in terms of the relationship between the executive and the legislative branches and what is the role of classified employees, not in terms of and the share flow of information between those two branches of government. I have no problem with saying that sharing good, accurate information to citizens, you know, should be allowed. I suspect that that is covered more fully in the data privacy laws that I believe that you understand more fully, and whether or not violations of those provisions have other consequences, I don't know. I've never heard of a state employee being disciplined for giving information to a member of the public, but that may be, but that my experience is limited.
Representative Gulfstream.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to know if it's also reciprocal. If we have a conversation as legislators with a state employee, and then that state employee runs around with the information that we have shared with them, would they also be protected then under this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, it's my understanding, and I would defer to counsel to interpret this, that that there are provisions in law right now that work both ways in terms of a state agency staff working with the governor on his proposals or policy proposals is not required to disclose that to us as legislators, and that if they're working with us on a legislative initiative, they're not they can't disclose that without authority from the elected person they're working with to the governor's staff. But I defer to counsel on that. My understanding is that's covered in other provisions. It was related to, I believe, under Governor Carlson, there was an attempt by someone to gain access to budget decision-making materials, and that led to some legislative work.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I guess I'm not quite as familiar with the other protections that exist for legislative communications, but the way this bill is structured, because you're also allowing the protection for communication to a constitutional officer, I think if if you had an employee, and a classified employee who spoke with the legislator about state services, and that employee then went to the governor or some constitutional officer and discussed what you had been talking about, then they would be protected by this bill.
All right, thank you.
Okay, with that, I don't see any other. Yes, the chair will renew his motion to pass House File 1531 as amended and send it to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Division? Okay, all in favor, raise your hands. All opposed? Chair has good ears. It carries. And with that, then we are adjourned. Thank you.